Greetings, and bienvenue, Midnight Crew. Thank you for returning to this broadcast. And welcome to new viewers joining us for the first time. If you like a video, then feel free to subscribe.
Tonight, Anon posts claims of historic explorers of the Inner Earth.
Okay, fellow spelunkers, I'm going to share some Inner Earth entrance stories. Enjoy. On the 21st of March, 1961...
Thinking about a change, skill up in 2024 with
Canada at the invitation of another amateur underground explorer. Point of interest, the iron mines of Newfoundland province. Although not generally known, one of these mines, one of the deepest, by the way, had caused much concern and controversy among the local populace. Shortly after it had been dug to its maximum depth, strange things began to happen. Miners working late at night in small groups of 6 to 10 began hearing noises, not rumbling or other natural mine noises, but what some described as strange music. It seemed to come from all around them, sometimes faint and sometimes distinct. Later, some said they heard mumbling and voices. This went on for several months, but only the miners who had heard the noises were disturbed or concerned. Then more serious things began to happen. One of the men entered the mine late at night to check on some equipment, and when he finished and started to leave, some small men grabbed him from behind, knocked his lamp from his hands, and shot him with something that forced him violently against the mine wall, knocking him unconscious. In the morning, workers found him apparently none the worse for his experience physically, but quite shaken mentally. He said he would never again enter a mine and promptly dropped out of the occupation. A few days later, a miner on the night watch disappeared. Investigators found his lamp and hat deep within the mine, but no trace of the miner. Soon lights and machinery began to fail or work erratically for no apparent reason. Men became hesitant to work the mine. Finally, it was condemned and shut down. This was the mine in which our Canadian friend was interested and wanted us to help investigate. Although spelunking is usually confined to exploration of naturally formed caves, our curiosity was great enough to spur us on to such an unusual form of research. We arrived in the mining town, which was near the Newfoundland-Quebec border, at 11:30 a.m. on March 22nd, and lodged at the local hotel. The next day, we got our equipment together, loaded up our jeep, and headed for the mine. At the entrance, we were stopped by two policemen who warned us not to go inside. When we persisted, they threatened to arrest us, so we left, resolving to return on foot after dark. At 1:30 a.m., we again set out for the mine. This time we bypassed the police and approached the mine from a different direction. We met no interference along the way and shortly arrived at the entrance. While Rick Grayton, my American friend, stayed at the entrance as lookout, Don Lawrence, our Canadian friend, and I descended into the mine. It was in excellent shape and showed no signs of any deterioration whatsoever, hardly the type of mine the government would condemn its physical state alone. We had just completed our preliminary investigation when we heard someone, apparently deep within the mine, shout in a high-pitched voice, "Come!" We stopped dead in our tracks and walked in the general direction from where the voice seemed to originate. Then we heard somebody or something running. We lit a flare but saw nothing. We continued and again heard the running. By this time we were getting far back in the mine, and also very curious and excited. The running sounds ceased abruptly, and we saw a faint blue light radiate from a far recess. Then we heard what we thought was the clank of a metal door closing. We quickly found the area from which we saw the light radiating, but no door or opening could be found. However, upon tapping the walls with my pick hammer, we heard hollow metallic reports at several places. After we had localized the hollow-sounding area, we marked it off by chiseling off pieces of rock and found that it was generally rectangular in shape, almost 5 feet in height and about 2 feet wide. Since we could investigate no further with the equipment at hand, we decided to come back the following night and continue our investigation. Returning the following night, all three of us entered the mine. Very much to our surprise, the chisel marks were gone. It took us several minutes to find the hollow area again, but we finally did. And this time, we had come prepared. Using a battery-powered rock drill, we penetrated about 3 inches into the rock when we struck metal. We withdrew it and substituted a bit designed to drill into metal. Eventually, we breached the metal and, withdrawing the drill, we again saw the soft blue light shining as before. Suddenly, we heard a low humming noise and were startled to see the section of the wall we were working on abruptly lift out of sight. It would be an understatement to say we were frightened. What lay before us was incomprehensible, a blue-lighted corridor which appeared to be made of some sort of translucent, seamless, self-illuminating, blue-colored metal or plastic. At first, we were very apprehensive about investigating the enigmatic hallway. Our curiosity soon overcame our fear, however, and we entered the corridor. We had to stoop, for the hallway was only 5 feet in height. After walking about 50 yards, we came to another corridor leading off to our left and decided to explore it. We reached the end of the corridor after walking about 100 yards. There we encountered a steep, spiraling stairway. We descended it for at least 20 minutes, all the while noting that the lighting was becoming more brilliant. Finally, we reached the bottom and were confronted with yet another corridor, this one light green in color. After a brief rest, we set off down that corridor. It was only about 100 feet long, and we traversed it quickly. To the right and left were oval entrances. Making a quick decision, we decided to enter the one on the right and noticed immediately that it was cylindrical shaped and much larger than the previous passageways. It contained a floor on the same level as the previous ones. We also noted that this passage was evidently made of some crystalline substance and that a bright but soft white light emanated from it. It curved downward at a slight angle. We next came to a huge chamber which appeared to be some type of scientific laboratory and hydroponic garden. In one section were rows of giant exotic plants, and in another some type of chemistry equipment. Lining the walls of this laboratory were arrays of multi-sized TV screens, dials, gauges, and other electronic equipment. Some of the screens were at least 10 feet square. In the center section was a great mass of scintillating vara-colored crystal. They had a rough natural exterior, and apparently performed some unknown function. The rest of the chamber contained many other strange devices and apparatus that none of us could identify. The entire ceiling was one great light. At its far end stood something that looked like a car lift, with a disc-shaped metal object resting on it. We decided to take a closer look at it. Fortunately, the lift was only about 2 feet off the floor, and we got a good look at the object. It was circular in shape, about 35 feet in diameter and 4 feet in thickness. Suddenly, Don exclaimed, "It's a flying saucer!" We both agreed we had indeed found a UFO. Rick stepped up on the lift to take a more detailed look at the saucer. He tapped on it lightly with his hammer, and parts of it sounded hollow. Immediately after he tapped on one certain spot, an entire section of its shell dematerialized. This took Rick totally by surprise, and he almost fell off the lift platform. About one half of the inner mechanism was revealed to us, and again we could not find a single piece of equipment with which we were familiar. The only thing we could surmise was that the object was a remotely controlled device, since there was no space provided for passengers that we could see. Rick jumped down from the lift, and we continued our investigation of the laboratory. Abruptly, the lift was activated and began to drop to the floor. And at the same time, the lighting in the chamber changed from a soft white to a deep red. In short order, the screen directly above and to the right of us flashed on. Due to the unnatural lighting, we could not make out the image on the screen. Then we heard a voice from the screen. It said, in a high-pitched voice, "You have been expected. You have been observed since first you entered our domain. You gaze upon the upper regions of our world. You are the first of your kind to be permitted this privilege. Let it be known this truth. We harbor you no ill will. We depend not upon your superficial world for our sustenance or pleasure. Those of your kind who make themselves the interpreters of our intentions are naught but the picayunish deceivers of your civilization. Let it again be said that we desire man no harm, and wish only to pursue our independent existence on this, our mutual planet. We shall not influence nor bring to you discord in any medium. We are not doers of evil. Our world spans the inner gulf of your globe. We have existed since before your time. Had we wished harm upon you, we also would have been its receivers. We beg you a friendly farewell, and hope our message will be heeded and find wide acceptance among those of your kind who find it necessary to concern themselves with our domain." The screen then faded, without our having seen a clearly defined image of the person who had spoken. Luckily, Don had quickly written in his notebook what the voice had said to us. The red lighting in the chamber suddenly became even deeper in tint, and all of us felt lightheaded. Rick shouted he was going to faint and started to fall, but we caught him. Then we, too, had the same feeling and blacked out. When we regained consciousness, we found ourselves lying outside the mine entrance. We still retained our personal effects, notebooks, pencils, wallets, etc., but all our equipment, such as safety hats, pick hammers and chisels, and our Geiger counter, had disappeared. After returning to the States, Don found all the pages of his notebook burned or charred, as though it had been thrown into a roaring fire. The notebook cover, however, which was made of plastic, was surprisingly undamaged. All of us had worn wristwatches with radium dials. Some weeks later, the radium became inactive, and the dials no longer glowed in the dark. Further investigation by Arnold White filled in a few more details. The police reported they found the three young men outside the mine, wandering in a dazed condition. They took them to the local police station and questioned them at some length. They related essentially the same story that has appeared above. The police would not comment as to whether they believed the story or not. However, the earlier incidents which had led to the closing of the mine probably returned to their minds as they heard the account. A person who lived near the mine told White that immediately after the incident related above, police put around the clock guard at the entrance, and that a few days later, the entrance was dynamited and closed.
The following letter, which appeared on page 128 of the June 1953 issue of Fate magazine, The Devil's Tramping Ground in the February 1953, issue of Fate is similar in some respects to the story in the November-December 1951 issue, The Mysterious Circles of Shasta, better known as the Siskiyou Stone Circles. They were made for a specific purpose and are still in use. I believe I know what the circles are used for. They were made by the little people who live either beneath the surface of the surrounding terrain or within the mountain itself. There is no law, written or unwritten, that says people have to live upon a planet's surface. It is safer to dwell within a planet. These people are not the only inhabitants of this region. There are others too, and I don't mean U.S. citizens either, and they possess great knowledge which they use well. Umberto Y. Orsi, New York, New York. It seems impossible to believe that these persistent reports, these frequent sightings, are hallucinations. But consider several other matters recently reported in the newspapers. What about these? Alfred Scadding of Kingswood Road, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, is the sole survivor of three men trapped in the famous 1936 Moose River mine disaster. Recently, Scadding made a confession to George Bryant of the Toronto Daily Star. Minutes before the mine caved in, he said he was on his way to join the others. I came to a crossout, a tunnel running across the one I was in, and as I passed, I looked left. I saw a small light, like a flashlight, about 2 feet from the ground and swinging as if in someone's hand, moving away from me. Yet, as we later learned, there wasn't another human being down there at that time. Bryant recalls the belief of older miners in the reality of gnomes. If they are seen, it portends a big strike or a major disaster. And 2 minutes after I saw that light, the mine came in on us. After they were trapped, Scadding and Dr. Eddie Robinson, both conscious and apparently clear-headed, heard a sound like children playing off in the distance. There was shouting and laughter, as if the little people were having fun, he says. We both heard it so clearly we thought there was a vent to the surface, but there wasn't. It went on for 24 hours, following which they were rescued.
Man who made vain trial describes astonishing experience. Alpine, Texas, Saturday. Another futile effort has just been made to explore the shaft and underground workings of the so-called haunted refugee mine in the Chispa Mountains, 60 miles southwest of here. The mine was worked by the Spaniards more than a century ago. It was abandoned and forgotten until about 20 years ago, when an American mining engineer, Henry Boyd, while looking up the title to a Mexican mining property, came across a mention of it in the archives of the state of Coahuila at Saltillo, Mexico. The records gave a careful description of the property and its location. They showed that it was worked for 40 years prior to 1791, and that it produced during that time more than $7 million of silver ore. Accompanied by a Mexican guide, he left Saltillo for the Chispa Mountains. It was a one-long and fatiguing trip, and the two men experienced great hardships until they reached the little Mexican settlements along the Rio Grande south of here, where they made their headquarters while they made expeditions into the rough country north of there in search of the mine. The records showed in a general way where the mine was situated, but the exact spot could not be found until a Mexican sheepherder one day informed Boyd that he could show him the ruins of an ancient smelter. These ruins were situated in a deep canyon, and after a patient search, Mr. Boyd came upon the mouth of the shaft. Ladder made of hides. A crude ladder made of the hides of wild animals still hung in the shaft, and other evidence of a sudden abandonment of the mine were seen. What occurred when Mr. Boyd attempted to explore the mine is told in a letter which he wrote to James E. Meade, who resided in San Antonio at that time, but has engaged in business here for several years. The letter said, "A horrible and most astonishing thing has happened to me when I attempted to explore the mine. My Mose, servant, Pedro, let know down to the bottom of the shaft, a distance of about 100 feet by means of a rope. The candle gave poor light, but I could see that a great deal of net ore still remained in the workings. I had started to explore one of the drifts, when a noise like the bursting of a thousand cannons sounded in my ears, and was followed by a terrific rush of air which came from the drift that I was about to enter. I was lifted off of my feet and thrown against the rock walls of the shaft with such force that I was badly bruised and almost knocked senseless. The rush of air gradually subsided, and as it did so, there came echoing out of the murky drift one of the most piercing and plaintive cries I have ever heard. It was a wail that produced indescribable and uncontrollable terror in me. I fled for the rope, and quickly tying it around my body, I yelled to the Mexican to draw me up. There was no response from above. I yelled and yelled, but Pedro did not come to the rope. I then realized that he had heard the mysterious demonstration, and had fled in his superstitious terror. It was lucky that the rope was fastened to a mesquite trunk on the surface, as I was able to draw myself out of the shaft hand over hand, bracing my feet against the walls. Just as I reached the surface, the underground phenomenon was closed. Pedro was found at the home of a sheepherder 5 miles away. The story that the mine is haunted has spread throughout the Mexican settlements here, and as I can get no one to help me, I have abandoned all hope of further exploring the wonderful mine at this time. Mr. Boyd went to San Antonio to organize an expedition to undertake the work of exploring the mine. Before he had got his men together, he died. Mr. Meade then took charge of the expedition. They spent 3 months at the mine, but only one attempt was made to explore the underground workings, and that experience was so terrifying that the men, including the Americans and Mexicans, threatened to leave if forced to make another effort. They sunk a shaft near the old one to a depth of 50 feet. But the noises became so pronounced that the workmen refused to go on with it, and the whole project was abandoned. Since then, many attempts have been made to explore the mine, but the experience has proved more than any man is willing to stand a second time. Captain Lewis Sefton was at the head of the latest expedition to the haunted site. He is one of the most prominent stockmen in Texas, and has a reputation for great courage. In a spirit of adventure, he left his ranch in Sutton County a few days ago for the mine, taking with him a half dozen of his cowboys. They let the rope ladder down into the old shaft, and Captain Sefton and two of his cowboys went down to the bottom. All was quiet, and they had just started to enter the drift when the phenomenon suddenly broke forth in all its fury. The three men were hurled with great force several feet and thrown repeatedly against the jagged rocks of the shaft. It was only with the greatest effort that they could climb to the surface. Their bodies were covered with bruises and their clothing was torn.
The region of Jawajiti is a dense, very sparsely inhabited forest. It has been difficult for Venezuelan investigators to make contact with the people who live there. They shun outsiders, speak an unknown language, and do not understand Spanish. Locals from the town of Esmeralda on the Orinoco have been able to approach them, however. Strange people wearing strange clothes have been seen several times in the forest of Jawajiti, one of them reported. They seem unwilling to approach the natives, and they venture only a short distance away from the craters. Their skin is the color of yellowed ivory. They have big eyes like a jaguar's and long hair of different colors. They seem fearful and run away whenever they hear an unusual sound. They are thought to live at the bottoms of the craters and in vast underground rooms with secret entrances in the forest. Other reports would seem to indicate that the people of the Kingdom of Two Craters are in almost constant contact with space beings. But it should be pointed out that sightings of flying saucers are more common in Central and South America than anywhere else in the world. The natives of the forest say that at night the trees on the rim of each volcano are illuminated by a soft green light that apparently comes from the bottom. Occasionally something that looks like a little round airplane comes out of the darkness, enters the green halo, and disappears into the volcano. Two or three nights before David Knott, Brewer Carias, G. Dunsterville, and their companions came to the site, intensified activity by the flying things was observed. They were as numerous as a swarm of bees, but perhaps because of their distance from the observers, they flew without making any discernible sound. The natives felt that the strange people were receiving heavy reinforcements, or else that they were moving out before the archaeologists came. In any case, they left little trace of their presence in the underground passages, but enough to give convincing evidence that their existence is not a myth. The natives believe that the Kingdom of Two Craters extends under the mountains, and that, for the time being, its entrances are tightly closed. In Lima, Zizi Ganea told me that a little forest of trees extinct everywhere else grew inside the caves and the craters, and that in it lived animals from the tertiary. What is strange about the whole affair, in which legend is mingled with fact, is the Venezuelan government's inexplicable silence and secrecy in which the expedition's report has been kept.
There are many equally fascinating and unsubstantiated stories of subsurface tunnels in South America. Brazil has long been a hot point of inner earth belief, and several organizations devoted to its perpetuation maintain active chapters in the country's major cities. The discovery of a new hole in the ground, a strange cave, or an ancient temple will send a frantic horde of hollow earth investigators pouring into the locale. I have corresponded with several of these groups. Some of their letters read like the frantic scribblings of madmen. Others are rational, well-written, and fascinating, even if they are a bit bizarre. A sampling of this South American correspondence includes: the well-known English explorer Colonel Fawcett disappeared in the jungle several years ago. He was searching for a tunnel entrance into the subterranean world in the Roncador Mountains when he disappeared. He was not killed by the natives. He is living in a cavern city beneath the Roncador Mountains. His son Jack is also with him. They are well treated, but they are not allowed to return to the surface because they would reveal the location of the entrance. The entrance to the cavern city is carefully guarded by the Murchego tribe. They are a ferocious tribe with a highly developed sense of smell. You must obtain their approval before you can enter into the caverns. However, if they decide you are not worthy to share the secret, they will seldom allow you to return to civilization. There is a legend that the subterranean cities were originally constructed by the survivors of Atlantis. We don't know whether the present inhabitants are the descendants of the Atlanteans, or whether they died and there were other tribes who eventually wandered into the cavern cities and settled there amid peaceful surroundings, abundance, and happiness. Milinko S. Stevic, a Yugoslav-born engineer currently, at the time of this writing, lecturing on the United States parapsychological circuit, advances an even more startling theory. He holds that there are entire subterranean towns situated beneath such large surface centers as Tokyo, Leningrad, Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, and New York.
This is the Green Wizard, someone that I follow on Telegram, produces.
These underground cities are connected with each other by a system of tunnels. Apparently, such tunnels into the subsurface exist elsewhere in the world besides Brazil. In fact, one letter on file with us comes from Professor W. Weirs of Mexico, who tells us that he knew Professor Schwartz, who had made a long study of cave problems, starting when he was 15 years old in Germany. According to Professor Weirs, just before the beginning of the Second World War, both the Axis and Allied powers were interested in using various caves as supply bases and for many military applications. Professor Schwartz at one time had stated that he knew of a German who had come upon an enormous circular pit in Brazil, Branton, whose sides dropped straight down for a good 1,200 feet. Trees could be seen growing tall and straight below. Eagles soared around and then dived to the center of the bottom, apparently to eat something. Since the sides were dangerously steep, the German had to content himself with using binoculars instead of descending into this world himself. Returning later with others, he eventually discovered a similar but much narrower bore, or shaft, not far from the first, which was so big that it could not be hidden in any way. Not having cable or apparatus with which to let down a man in the seemingly bottomless shaft, they let down a pencil attached to a rope. To their surprise, the cord, when drawn back up, was found to be cut clean, as with a knife or scissors, and the pencil was gone. Of course, they all resolved to come back to study this pit further, but the war prevented their doing so. The location of this shaft is supposedly in northern Guatemala. Near the place is a witch doctor, friendly to Professor Schwartz, who assured the professor that there is a secret passage, closed by a revolving rock door, which goes to the still enormous chamber which is still below the vast roof cave-in seen from above.
The editors of Search present here a strange manuscript, or rather a letter, received by us from a man who claims to be a descendant of the Incas. Although he signed his name, he has asked us to withhold it for reasons of safety for himself and his family. We present his information with no comment other than that it is presented as received. Without actually accepting the invitation of the Inca to go to these caverns with him, nothing further can be said, one way or the other.
I am descended from the Inca tribe, which disappeared in a tunnel when the Spaniards invaded their country and continued to live in subterranean cities. The Incas were a tribe of vegetarians and pacifists, and when the Spaniards came to attack them, they did not fight, but escaped into tunnels and disappeared from the world. During all of my life, I have been searching for my lost tribe and traveled to many countries, as far north as Mexico, also in Venezuela, Chile, Paraguay, Argentina, Uruguay, and all parts of Brazil, investigating tunnels to find an entrance to the subterranean world. But I could not find anything, and lost, through swindlers claiming to bring me to Atlanteans under the earth, and spent 1.8 million cruzeiros, equivalent to $36,000. After my money was gone, I worked as a mechanic and saved money, and with it, I continued my investigations. After searching all the 21 states of Brazil and living a year in Mato Grosso among the savages, I finally found what I sought. One day I went to a river to drink water. On the other side was a high mountain. I heard a powerful voice coming from the top of the mountain, yelling many times. I thought it was a person lost in the forest and asking for help. I swam the river to the other side and walked through the forest for an hour and then climbed for 2.5 hours. When I reached the top, I found a hole in the ground. It was very deep, as I found by dropping a stone down. I then gathered vines from trees, tied them together, fastened a stone at the end and dropped it down until it hit bottom. I pulled it up and it measured 100 meters or 330 feet. Then I returned to Joinville and told Dr. Raymond Bernard about this, who gave me money to buy a rope. I returned to the mountain, and by means of the rope I descended. When I came to the bottom, I entered a tunnel, which I traversed for a distance of 2,000 meters. I then saw, with my flashlight, a door of stone. While I was watching the door, it suddenly opened, and I saw a very tall man with a metallic uniform, who spoke with a powerful voice, and said that this was the first time that anyone ever had the courage to enter this tunnel. I first was frightened at the powerful voice of the man and wanted to run, but he called me and told me not to be afraid, as he was a very peaceful person who never did harm to any living being. So I asked him who he was to live in this cavern. He said, "I am an Atlantean Inca, the guardian of this door." He asked me what I was looking for. I told him I was looking for my tribe, because I too am an Inca. He seemed to be very pleased to hear this. I told him I would like to visit his city, and that I had an American friend, and a wife who would like to go there too with my children. He told me to bring photographs of my wife, children, and American friend, and if they were found acceptable, he would give permission for them to enter. I then returned to Dr. Bernard, who gave me his own photo, and I brought all the photos, including those of my wife and children, back to the Atlantean. On this second visit to the Atlantean, he delivered a lecture on radioactivity and its danger. He said that radioactive dust in the air is now causing surface dwellers to age very rapidly because it accumulates in the pores of the skin and stops skin respiration. He said the pores of the skin have a constant alternate contraction and expansion and serve to take in air and expel foreign matter. Note, there are those who believe that not only radioactive dust but also solar radiation causes surface dwellers to age faster, which is why the subterraneans who are not exposed to such radiations, and also the antediluvians, who lived at a time when the earth was surrounded by a Venus-like canopy of water vapor, which blocked out most of the harmful solar radiations, had lifespans of several hundred years. However, as a result of man's rebellion against his creator,
and their unbalancing of the natural order, this vaporous canopy condensed and fell to earth as the deluge. Branton. In an atmosphere of radioactive dust and amp, metals, these substances clog up the pores and interfere with their vital functions of respiration and excretion. This causes disease and early death. The Atlantean called me to come near a transparent screen to make an exchange of blood, to make sure I will preserve the secret of the whereabouts of this tunnel, so that I do not reveal it to an unworthy person. When I was near the curved plastic screen, another curved plastic screen suddenly appeared from each side of the door and encompassed me, so that I found myself inside the two curved plastic screens. Then it seemed that all air was pumped out, leaving a vacuum in the space where I was between the plastic screens. Then other air entered, which seemed lighter and purer, which made me feel more healthful and stronger. Then the inside plastic door opened, and he put inside a man-sized capsule of this transparent substance, which he held by handles on both sides of it, and told me to go inside the open door. After I was inside, the door automatically closed. Now the second plastic door opened, and the Atlantean took hold of the handles on each side of the capsule and carried me to the other side of the inside plastic screen, whose doors automatically opened and shut. Then he inserted his hands into two soft pockets in the capsule, made of the same material, and took hold of a metal device which he lowered on the chain and wire with which it was suspended from the curved top of the capsule. The base was flat for me to stand on, and put it on my head. Then he went over to an electrical apparatus, from which a recording tape emerged, and I heard a ticking sound, much like a telegraphic ticker. Then he read the tape, put it in a box, and spoke in a funnel-shaped speaker in a strange language. It seemed to be a radio telephone. Then he asked me for the photos. He told me to put my hand on one part of the capsule with a very delicate wall. He told me to push my hand through, which I did, and the material adhered to my hand like an elastic, so as not to permit any air from inside the capsule to leave, since he was afraid of my having contaminated the air inside the capsule by what I exhaled. Then he sprayed my hand with the purpose of radioactive decontamination. He took the photos from my hand and slid them into an opening in the same electrical apparatus. Then more tape emerged, which he read and then spoke by radio telephone to headquarters below. He then looked at a sort of small television apparatus with a horizontal screen, apparently to see the persons he was speaking to. He told me not to bring here any unworthy person, because he would know it in advance. I asked how. He said that with this apparatus, which he called an electrovisor, he could behold whatever was occurring in any part of the world. If any unworthy person comes near the mountain and tries to get to the tunnel opening, certain rays confuse the person's mind so that he is unable to continue the trip and will go off in the wrong direction. I had some bread in my pocket. He told me not to eat the bread. He put a white pill in my hand, which was projected outside the capsule all the time, and told me this pill had the taste of many fruits and that his people live entirely on it. I believe it is a concentrate of the vitamins of fruits. Then I withdrew my hand and the elastic material through which it projected closed. After he gave me the pill, he carried the capsule with me inside to the space between the two plastic screens, as the door of the inside screen opened to admit the capsule and then automatically shut. Then the door of the capsule opened. I left the capsule, and then the door of the outside plastic screen opened, and I left. When newcomers enter, they first enter the capsule, and the Atlantean carries them to a decontamination chamber, the Atlantean told me. The door of the capsule opens. The person leaves the capsule, takes off his clothing, then the chamber becomes filled with vapor which draws forth radioactive poisons from his body. The person dresses with other clothing there, ready for him, then enters an electronic apparatus, which carries him to the center of the Earth. That is into the geoconcavitic portion of the Earth's coconut-like shell, some 800 miles below. In fact, some believe that the Creator in his infinite wisdom created all or most planets hollow, in keeping with some sort of cosmic law of conservatism. Branton. I should mention that during my visits, before the door opened, I heard a peculiar humming sound, which was of the apparatus with which the Atlantean came up from below, which became louder and louder as the apparatus came near. And when it came to a stop, the noise stopped, and the doors automatically opened. I should also mention that when a flying saucer came near my house on Saturday, June 13th, 1959, in the afternoon and night, it gave off an identical hum as this subterranean apparatus, which makes me think they are both operated by the same mechanism, and that the flying saucer was an apparatus of these same subterranean Atlanteans and did not come from another planet. The flying saucer came describing, performing, a spiral, which descended on top of a hill about 2,000 meters from my house, and then rose in a spiral manner with a tail of light behind it. It came in the night, had a round shape and a silver color. I believe it was sent by subterranean Atlanteans, who knew where I lived and came especially near my house. We are now 21 vegetarians. This is necessary for those who wish to enter the subterranean world. And if any of you wish to enter, you may send me your photos for presentation to the Atlantean to secure permission for you to enter. I am sending you this as an invitation to come here, and I will guarantee to bring you to the Atlantean and to the subterranean world. I wish you to reply and tell me whether you care to come or not. We will then tell you when to come and meet us. Await our reply, as we are now building a boat and an elevator, and when these are ready, we will advise you to come and meet us in Joinville. This may seem like a lie or a story, and many people will not believe that a subterranean world, which is a utopia, exists. But it exists! I know it exists, because I made this discovery and saw with my own eyes. The door I came to leads to a tunnel through which the Atlantean came up from the subterranean world in the center of the Earth on an electrical apparatus, and there exists the cities of this interior world called Agartha. When the boat, to cross the river, and the elevator, to descend into the tunnel, are ready, I will enter with my family and bring them to the subterranean world. Then I will return to wait for your coming and will bring you there. In that world, there is no radioactivity to poison the air and foods, as here. That world has no bad people, no swindlers, no crooks. All the people there are good, pure, and vegetarians. They do not eat bulky vegetables as we do here. There they live entirely on fruit concentrates prepared as pills, which dissolves in your mouth and eat nothing else. I say this because the Atlantean delivered a talk to me and told me all what I said and gave me a pill, which I ate. It made me feel as strong as a bull and very warm, and it seemed as if I overate. I ate it on my way back and could not walk, so I lay down and went to sleep for several hours until I got over the feeling of overeating. On that pill, I returned to Joinville full of energy, and for the following 3 days, I could not eat a thing, as I had no appetite, because the pill had a high concentration of the vitamins of fruits, and was so nourishing that I had no further need for food. Now we are working on the boat and elevator, and the moment when they are finished, 10 vegetarians here in Joinville, including 3 men, 1 woman, and 6 children, will go up the mountain and descend into the subterranean world. The youngest of this group is only 1 week of age. I want my newborn child not to live and grow up in this radioactively contaminated atmosphere and eat food full of radioactive poisons. I want it to grow up in a better world, free from radioactivity, and live on these fruit concentrate pills in place of the radioactively contaminated foods here. Sincerely, the Inca, the end.
Well, there you go.
I hope that you enjoyed tonight's broadcast. If you enjoyed tonight's story, then please subscribe to the channel as more green tips will appear daily. A new broadcast will appear.
Well, there you go. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, baby. Blowing your mind. Alright, we're out. Thanks for listening.